Hi, my name is Michael Creamer, and welcome to a podcast series where I talk to leading industry experts about how property can help business perform with a focus on the employee and what works for them. And as we all know, workplace design has never been more important than now. Today, we're going to discuss a wide range of topics in an area that we haven't talked about before, and that's the evolution of workplace design and where it might go next. To do this, I have in the virtual studio Dr. Amy Thomas, who's an assistant professor of the history of architecture and urban planning at TU Delft in Holland. Welcome, Amy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Our pleasure. And maybe by way of background, Amy, you could give us a little bit of the sort of history of how you ended up being an assistant professor, because of course that's very relevant to the conversation we're going to have.
Sure. Well, I trained as an art historian at the University of Edinburgh, but very quickly moved into architectural history because of the way it really captures the history of societies, of people, of social discourse. You can't look at a building as a historian without understanding something about the way it intertwines with politics, economics, sociology, aesthetics, culture, and even psychology or identity and philosophy, depending on how far you want to take it. So for me, it was really something that said much more than simply what the building looked like, but actually could tell you something about the society. Following that, I did a master's and a PhD at the Bartlett School of Architecture at University College London, which has an amazing faculty of historians and theorists who also play an important role in the design curriculum. And my PhD there was on the City of London, the financial district. And specifically, I was trying to understand the relationship between the massive financial and political changes that took place in the UK in the second half of the 20th century and the built environment. And this was at all scales. So from the city, street, facade to interior, these were the four sections of my PhD. And really, this is important because it's gone on to inform the rest of my work. And I'm really interested in kind of how abstract terms like deregulation have real physical or concrete impacts from the level of urban planning and public space to the design of buildings and right down to office furniture. So my point was really that the designed elements of a city have to be understood as interconnected phenomena that are linked by multiple systems rather than as sort of isolated individual things. And following that, I taught for 2 years at the University of Chicago in the art history department. And it's here I really learned about the North American CBD par excellence and trying to understand the differences between US and UK real estate, commercial architecture, and the workplace. And that was a really great experience. Then following that, I moved to Delft, well, actually Rotterdam, and I work at Delft University of Technology in the Netherlands, where I've been for nearly 3 years. Another flat country with a history of iconic design. So it was quite a shift, but also had some similarities. And since then, my work's really been focusing more on the workplace as a dimension of commercial architectural history.
Well, that's quite a background, and I know we've chatted a bit about it before and about Chicago and the as you say, the iconic buildings that are there. Maybe we could start with workplace and then move on to building owners and then perhaps talk about the city, because there's a lot of ground to cover. But maybe we could start with, from a historical point of view, what has the industry typically done or not done when it comes to the workplace?
Well, I think the industry has always been more focused on the modes of production rather than the nature of organizations, generally speaking. So if we take, for example, the first office boom in the US that happened at the end of the 19th century after what some people have called the second industrial revolution. So this is a moment when the oil industry in America is booming. We see massive investment in raw materials, steel production, etc. And through this you see the rise of these very, very large, dense urban areas, cities, and the rise at the same time of white collar work. And so with this, there's a kind of necessity for office buildings and a kind of new kind of architecture to house these new workers and this new kind of work. And if you look at what was actually being written and sort of said about the workplace at that time, it was very much being informed by the systems of management that were also controlling the modes of production in factories and in manufacturing. And that is sort of more broadly known as Taylorism. This is really the kind of process, if you think of the Henry Ford car plants, the automobile factories, you know, that were innovative in creating this kind of assembly line mode of production. This then went on to be kind of theorized in management theory, known as Taylorism. And then this was sort of transported into the workplace. So the idea was that you should have sort of assembly line of clerical workers, and that each person was really a kind of unit of production. And so offices were sort of originally designed like factories. You know, if you look at them, heavily industrial looking, open plan, very clear displays of hierarchy and supervision. And then, you know, you had people like Frank and Lillian Gilbreth who did their time and motion studies, who were looking at, you know, what's the minimum possible movements that a worker can do to get the job done. And this was also transferred into secretarial and clerical workers. And there's a brilliant scene in the opening of the film, The Crowd by King Vidor, where you see all of these clerical workers coming in with this mechanical precision, really kind of operating as a machine. Then in
that's
the 1920s...
That's really not a pretty picture you're painting, by the way.
No, but you would be surprised how many of those principles have continued, actually, to the present day. Or maybe not surprised. But then, of course, as you sort of move through the 20th century, there's a kind of apparent softening, really, of these principles. And this was really began by the famous Hawthorne studies, which was a sort of series of experiments that were done to test whether the physical environment, changes in the physical environment, would impact the productivity of workers. So you see, the productivity is still the core goal. But actually, what they realized was that actually it was the social environment that had a bigger impact. And so these women, female workers, were initially monitored in isolation, and their productivity increased as they were working with other people in small groups. And this then led to human resources and the principles of management, good management, that have really kind of continued in one form or another to the current situation. Now, these ideas obviously became much more influential when the knowledge economy became more prevalent, and it was about sort of taking care of individuals and trying to nurture individuals to become ultimately more productive workers. But and I think you can see this come into design in several different ways around about the mid-century. So there's a strand of thinking called systems thinking, which was that the company, the corporation, is effectively a series of systems, and so that the office workplace should be designed as such. And this is where, in Germany, this concept of office landscaping emerged. And the idea was basically that you want to kind of treat an office as a piece of landscape. So you might, rather than having kind of rows of desks, you would have clusters of desks organized according to, you know, the way that people communicate, the system of communication. But the big thing about this was that it looked like a landscape. So they had plants decorating it. So it was shifting from this kind of very, very industrial look to actually being something a lot softer. People could bring their own things to decorate the space. You could personalize it. Now, of course, the principles of productivity, hierarchy were still at play. They just weren't as visible. And interestingly, the movement didn't last that long because those principles of hierarchy were not visible. Maybe that's something we can talk about later. Hierarchy has always been kind of key, actually, in the design of the workplace. And then when we see the kind of emergence of the knowledge economy, these ideas start to be taken in a kind of different form with the rise of sort of environmental psychology in the US and people like Frank Duffy being some of the first designers to actually engage in sociological research and to see how actually user-focused research can be very highly impactful in the design of spaces. And this was, you know, people like Robert Gutman, who was a sociologist working at Princeton, or Christopher Alexander at UC Berkeley, designers who were really engaged in this kind of social and sociological and psychological project. And I think, you know, these were people at the kind of in the avant-garde almost, you know, this was in the academy that was happening. And DEGW, Frank Duffy, who's, you know, one of the founding partners of DEGW, were one of the few firms to actually bring this into practice that has now obviously been taken up by many more people. But this idea that somehow an organization is a sort of has a kind of self-organizing principle behind it, or that the environment is determined by a kind of natural set of human behaviors, was incredibly important to kind of shaping this new way of looking at the workplace, which really begins in sort of the 1960s and the 70s. And I think is really maybe now kind of experiencing a resurgence, but you know, a few figures kind of continued this, but this was really with the rise of the knowledge economy. And the way that this is different from, say, something like Taylorism is that where Taylorism depended on these kind of command and control tactics, being able to see everybody at the same time, sort of supervision, the knowledge economy really relies on the onus of the individual. So the individual taking responsibility for productivity, sort of self-improvement, and, you know, the famous management theorist Peter Drucker said that we have to think of our workers as an investment. We invest in them and they sort of change over time. And so workplace design obviously then became about creating these individual experiences as much as the collective and enabling these places, or at least in the sort of theory of workplace design that being put forward by people like Duffy, that it was a kind of user-centered approach to design where the individual and the user was key. Whether that actually was taken on in the mainstream is a sort of a different question. I think it certainly isn't the case that most workplaces are designed with the user in mind, but we certainly see many of these principles, you know, creating workplaces that are social spaces, creating workplaces that are collaborative spaces, that are sort of softer versions of the workplace, is definitely of the zeitgeist, of the kind of current social paradigm.
Yeah, and I guess, I mean, that's a fascinating and quick run through the sort of the history of design of an office space. But I think what I'm hearing you say is that with some notable exceptions, the design of office space, and let's say over the last, it has shifted from this industrial platform, if I can call it that, into something that's a bit more in tune with the employee and is beginning to take on board factors other than pure production of work. Because you're dealing with humans, so it's not we're not a machine. We're human, and therefore there's other things that will make us perform better or worse that we need to incorporate. But it still seems like there's not a lot of research that has pulled all this together in a way that it can become more mainstream. Is that an accurate reflection of what's been happening? And I'm going to say pre-pandemic, because then I want to ask you a question about what's happening now, because I think there's a shift going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is definitely a shift towards nurturing individuals as opposed to nurturing a kind of the corporation as a whole. But that said, the kind of legitimacy and depth of those experiments, it varies greatly. And whether it's actually making a difference or not, I guess that can only be shown in the data of, you know, the things that Cushman & Wakefield are doing, gathering that kind of information. I mean, I think it's worth mentioning a couple of other things, really, about the history of the workspace and how it's changed, because this is very much thinking about the interior of the workspace. But we have to also connect that to the building itself. And there's been a huge shift over the last 100 years in the way we think about commercial architecture and corporate architecture. Now, before really the 1980s, at least in the UK, commercial architecture was really considered to be the lowest of the low when it came to the designers, the work that designers were doing, and particularly after the Second World War. And this was really because all of the money that was being spent on public on architecture was really going into public buildings, so schools or housing or rebuilding the public life of the nation after the devastation of the Second World War. And around about 50% of architects after the Second World War were employed by the state, which is quite remarkable. I mean, if you think now, it's probably less than 1%. And so since the Second World War to now, there's been a major shift. And partly that was to do with the kind of move to a more market-based economy, particularly with the emergence of Thatcherite economics in the 1980s. And the processes of incentivizing commercial architecture, putting business first, but also deregulating the architecture industry. So getting rid of the fixed fee structures that used to exist and making the whole sector more competitive. And this also was in tandem with a kind of dismantling of the state. So getting rid of those state sponsored commissions. So because of that, architects have had to move into the commercial sector, but also the commercial sector was booming because of things like financial deregulation, etc., putting the UK on the map and putting London on the map as a kind of global financial center. So because of that, you see a major shift in the status of commercial architecture. There's now much, much more money, time, effort, etc., dedicated to producing very high quality office buildings, not to mention the kind of culture of the icon that's really taken over in some of the sort of prestige buildings, and this is also occurring because of the emergence of a global economy, the need to transmit certain messages beyond the local context, but to sort of global context. Now, of course, this has always been done to an extent. If you look back historically with colonialism or through international trade, commercial buildings had a very important role there, but they didn't have the visibility that they now do through, the internet age and the sort of spread of mass media. And so I think there's also sometimes a disconnect between the amount of emphasis that's put on the public image of a building versus the way that use is considered within that building. If that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. But and so, I mean, there's always that. Well, there's obviously the juxtaposition of the owner and the occupier, and then frequent conversations that owners haven't thought enough about the occupier, but then the occupier's not knowing exactly what they want. So I think there's that's been going on. But I think in the recent part, and obviously there's planning restrictions and all sorts of things that mean building owners can only build in certain heights and certain floor plates and all these other good things. But do you see the design of the interior of the office reflecting the buildings into which they go and the parts of the cities to which they go? So maybe we can broaden that out. And I think this goes back to some of the things you looked at in your PhD. Mm-hmm. But do you get clustering within cities, let's say, of different types of buildings, shapes of buildings, uses for buildings? Is that fair, or is it not being driven by that?
I think there is a very strong connection between the nature of the workplace and the design of the workplace and the place that it's in. I mean, if you look across different cultural contexts, workplaces take on quite different forms, and those relate to kind of cultural norms, but they also relate to things like workers' rights, for example. You know, if the user, if workers have a stronger voice within the organization, that as they do in the Netherlands, for example, then they automatically have much more say in the design of the workplaces, and there are kind of mandatory consultations with the work with users in the Netherlands. There's also the case here that the trend generally is that you have many more occupier-owned buildings than you would in the UK context. And so there's often more experimentation that goes on there because it's very suited to the needs of a specific owner. And users might have more of a say in that context. So I think, you know, when we think about place, we can think about morphology. We can think about, say, the City of London, for example, having the most inconvenient footprints for building office buildings. And, you know, the problems this caused in the 1980s when the process of deregulation happened, and, you know, this kind of boom in the necessity for buildings that had huge dealing floors with big floor-to-ceiling heights, you know, to accommodate wiring and cooling. And the kind of, you know, the lack of, basically the need to build an American building, but without having the American grid there, because America was sort of leading the way in that. That's all obviously very important, but I think there's also a need to look more broadly. There are many things in different national contexts that shape space, whether it be sort of social influences, cultural influences, or literally to do with the fact that you're, in the case of Chicago, building an office building on a swamp, yeah, and having to have huge raft foundations underneath. And, you know, that requires a certain building type. So, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and of course, that's part of the reason that Canary Wharf came into being in a part of town that no one wanted to go to. But we haven't got long enough to talk about the rise and fall and rise again of Canary Wharf, as it were. But you mentioned one thing there, and I know this is something you're very passionate about, so I wanted to make sure we had time to talk about it, and that's, you know, the role of gender in all of this. And I know that's something you're looking at as part of what you're doing at the university. So can you maybe sort of open up the conversation around, I guess, maybe what we call gender-specific design, or what's going on in the industry today in that context that is influencing some of the things we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, you know, we frequently hear a lot about, you know, women not being equally represented in the C-suite, or women, you know, generally facing systemic discrimination in the workplace. And this is something that is written about and documented widely. We also hear a lot about, you know, creating more workplaces that enable well-being, that enable better kind of qualities of life for workers. We also hear about equity in the workplace, but actually the combination of those two things is never really married. So my question is, you know, if we look historically, women have always been the lowest common denominator in the workplace. I mean, this has changed obviously in the last 20 years or so, but historically speaking, women were always the lowest paid workers with the lowest rights. And we also can see that there are very, very few cases of women being designers of the workplace. So the question is really, are those two things linked? And there are cases where we can sort of explicitly see this. I mean, so women traditionally occupied clerical positions. And this is, you know, the role of the typist, for example, because it was a sort of associated with dexterity and manual labor and something that women were allowed to do. This was something that was suitable for the female character. But of course, they were the lowest paid positions. And there's been some writing about this by a sociologist called Daphne Spain, who said that women occupied open floor positions, whereas men always historically occupied closed door positions. And so if you're in a closed door position, you are privy to conversations that don't go on in the open floor. And therefore you have more access to climbing the ladder, if you like. And, you know, we can see sort of very tangible things in the office. For example, if we look back at women clerical workers, they were often the objects of management theories rather than the subjects. So they were sort of things that were being done to them. So you see lots and lots of brochures about ergonomic design to improve the productivity of clerical workers, of female clerical workers. But yet many of these ergonomic pieces of furniture were designed with men's bodies as the model. You can also see this with the air conditioning, for example, which is set to all the tests were done on men. So it was looking at men's optimal metabolic rates and not women's, which is different. This is why you always see women with scarves on in the office place and men in the T-shirts. So, yeah, there are some very obvious things like that. But there are also sort of social barriers, and in particular thinking about historically you would have the segregation of lunchrooms, so sort of the office girls would have their own lunchroom. You would see women not being able to access the sort of the meetings, the client facing meetings that would go on maybe outside the office in a pub or in a tavern or a restaurant. So a sort of access, a barrier of access to the social life of work. And actually this is something that still goes on today. As we know, the data shows again and again and again that women occupy the position of caregivers in the family context more than men do. And so it's often women that are rushing home at the end of the day to pick up their children from school, not able to participate in the sort of after-work drinks, for example. Also, you know, can you think of many office buildings that have childcare facilities within them, or efficient and sort of nice rooms to breastfeed or pump milk that aren't just a cupboard in the basement. So there are, you know, there are many sort of things about the sort of social life of work that have an indirect or a direct impact on design. I think it's also worth saying, we spoke a little bit about this before, Michael, about the suburb and the role that the suburb has played historically in design. So, you know, again, thinking about the workplace, always have to think about it as being connected to this kind of wider urban and suburban context. And suburbs were really predicated, I mean, there were many sort of socio-political reasons for why suburbs came into being, but they relied on this notion that women would stay at home and look after the children, collect the children from school, and so on and so forth, while men would go to work. And so there was this kind of sense that home and work were complementary aspects of a man's life, whereas for women, when women started to go into the workplace, they were in diametric opposition because that distance made it very, very difficult. There are these sorts of elements, really, that have kind of contributed to a situation where women are now, and have actually been, represented in equal numbers in corporate workplaces since about the 1950s in some form or another, but yet have experienced a kind of inequality through the design process. One other element that's worth talking about as well is the design side of things, which sort of can't be ignored. And we can see that women have had very little influence, apart from a kind of few very, very important figures. They've had very little influence in the design of office interiors and the workplace. And at least, you know, we're talking about sort of 1950s to the 1970s, that was definitely the case, with the exception of people like Florence Knoll, obviously, who was very, very, very well known. But it's interesting how these inequalities that happening in the corporate workplace were also happening in the design world. And we can assume that there was some kind of correlation between that and the kind of physical formation of the workplace itself.
That's an extraordinary sort of interwoven things going on there, that whether it's conscious or unconscious, it nevertheless exists. Yeah, I guess we can only hope and wonder that it will change more quickly in the next 5 years than it seems to have not changed over the last, you know, few hundred. I mean, that's probably a whole different conversation as to how you go about doing that. I mean, I think I heard Goldman Sachs have put in a crash into their London building, and that's the first one, to your point, which I think Yeah, sort of an extraordinary stat that I wasn't aware of until someone told me. So yeah, a lot of what you say resonates with the things that make it difficult. I guess we kind of need to wrap up and maybe moving from that discussion into this sort of post-pandemic world. I mean, you mentioned earlier there is a lot of surveys and research and everything else that's beginning to come out. So I guess from your point of view, that's the future, not the past, and your specialism is the past, which of course means you've probably got the best view of what should happen, as opposed to what might happen. You know, I don't necessarily want to leave it on a somber note, but do you think, given everything you've said, that the let's call it the design industry, be that the architects designing new buildings or interior designers fitting out space for the office worker, do you think that industry has shifted enough and is continuing to shift to kind of rise to the challenge of what we now need to do?
Yeah, well, I'm not sure I'm the person to say whether it has or hasn't, but I think, you know, what's clear, especially when we look at the current pandemic, is that this notion that we need a physical space to work is definitely shifting. And that doesn't mean to say that architecture will no longer be important. It's going to be incredibly important, but it might just be in very, very different ways. I mean, the whole notion of remote working has obviously been building up and building up. And workplaces have taken on more of a role as a social space increasingly over the last 40 years. I wonder whether, if there isn't such a necessity to have, you know, prime real estate, whether there will be a shrinkage of the amount of office space consumed by people, and whether that will actually be more geared towards creating sort of social spaces and collaborative spaces. I'm also sort of quite interested in how we're seeing a kind of realization that we don't necessarily need to travel as much. And so there might be more of a focus towards a kind of localism rather than thinking in such a kind of global perspective. And then I wonder to myself, well, what does this mean for the future of the icon building? You know, if these are really kind of global advertisements for companies, do they need to sort of continue existing in the same way? Will that change? I think it's also interesting thinking about how we might reimagine the home and thinking about the domestic realm as being something more than just a space for family and care, and thinking possibly, you know, how the workplace companies might start thinking about investing in people's homes or in the way that people organize their spaces at home. And whether that will have a kind of more distributed office rather than something that's kind of so centered in the heart of the city. Go ahead, Michael.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I think you're right. And I think that's what's fascinating about the next few years for all of us in this industry, is that it is changing, and we've got to figure out what it is that is needed. And this blending between home and work that you describe is right in the center of it. We're also kind of out of time. and you and I have had long conversations before, so we could go on for hours. But it's been a real pleasure talking to you about this. And I think it'd be interesting to talk again when more data's out and you've done more research and we can continue the conversation. So thank you very much for joining me today, Amy.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome.